large as horses, who could speak and plan and remember. She tapped the steps ahead, the wood of her bow a hollow echo through the dark chamber, prodding the slit where the bolt had been fired. "The Fae must have memorized what stairs to avoid while living here," she observed as they cleared another few feet. "I don't think they were stupid enough to do an easy pattern, though." Indeed, the next bolt had emerged 3 steps down. The one after that, 5 apart. But after that, Sartak reached into his pocket and pulled out another handful of stones. They both squatted as he rolled a few down the stairs. Click. Nezrin was so focused on the wall ahead that she didn't consider where the click had come from. Not in front, but below. One heartbeat, she was crouched on a step. The next, it had slid away beneath her feet, a black pit yawning open beneath. Strong hands wrapped around her shoulder, her collar, a blade clattering on stone. Nezrin scrabbled for the lip of the nearest stair as Sartak held her, grunting at her weight, his long knife tumbling into the blackness beneath. Metal hit metal, bounced off it again and again, the clanking filling the stairwell. Spikes, likely a field of metal spikes. Sartak hauled her up, and her nails cracked on stone as she grappled for purchase on the smooth step. But then she was up, half sprawled on the stairs between Sartak's legs, both of them panting as they peered to the gap beyond. "I think we're even," Nezrin said, fighting and failing to master her shaking. The prince clasped her shoulder, while his other hand brushed down the back of her head, a comforting, casual touch. "Whoever built this place had no mercy for the Karen Kui." It took her another minute to stop trembling. Sartak patiently waited, stroking her hair, fingers rippling over the ridges of Borte's braid. She let him, leaned into the touch. While she studied the gap, they'd now have to jump, the stairs still beyond. When she could at last stand without her knees clacking together, they carefully jumped the hole and made it several more steps before another one appeared, this time accompanied by a bolt. But they kept going, the minutes dripping by, until they at last reached the level below. Shafts of pale light shone from carefully hidden holes in the ground above, or perhaps through some mirror contraption in the passageways high above. She didn't care, so long as the light was bright enough to see by. And see they did. The bottom level was a dungeon. 5 cells lay open, the doors ripped off, prisoners and guards long gone. A rectangular stone table lay in the center. "Anyone who thinks the Fae are prancing creatures given to poetry and singing needs a history lesson," Sartak murmured, as they lingered on the bottom step, not daring to touch the floor. "That stone table was not used for writing reports or dining." Indeed, dark stains still marred the surface. But a work table lay against the nearby wall, scattered with an assortment of weapons. Any papers had long ago melted away in the snow and rain, and any leather-bound books also gone. "Do we risk it or leave?" Sartak mused. "We've come this far," Nezrin said. She squinted toward the far wall. "There. There's some writing there." Near the floor, in dark lettering. A tangle of script. The prince just reached into his pockets, casting more stones throughout the space. No clicks or groans answered. He chucked a few at the ceiling, at the walls. Nothing. "Good enough for me," Nezrin said. Sartak nodded, though they both tested each block of stone with the tip of the bow or his fine, thin sword. They made it past the stone table, and Nezrin did not bother to examine the various instruments that had been discarded. She'd seen Kaol's men hanging from the castle gates, had seen the marks on their bodies. Sartak paused at the work table, sorting through the weapons there. "Some of these are still sharp," he observed. And Nezrin approached as he pulled a long dagger from its sheath, the watery sunlight caught in the blade. dancing along the markings carved down the center. Nezrin reached for a short sword, the leather scabbard nearly crumbling beneath her hand. She brushed away the ancient dirt from the hilt, revealing shining dark metal inlaid with swirls of gold, the crossguard curving slightly at its ends. The scabbard was indeed so old that it fell apart as she lifted the sword, its weight light despite its size, the balance perfect. More markings had been engraved down the fuller of the blade. A name or a prayer, perhaps. Only Feyblades could remain this sharp after 1,000 years, said Sartak, setting down the knife he'd been inspecting. Likely forged by the Feysmiths in Asterion, to the east of Doranel. Perhaps even before the first of the Demon Wars. A prince who had studied not only his own empire's history, but that of many others. History was certainly not her strongest subject, so she asked. Asterion? Like the horses?
One and the same. Great smiths and horse breeders. Or so it once was, before borders closed and the world darkened.
Nezrin studied the short sword in her hand, the metal shining as if imbued with starlight, interrupted only by the carvings down the fuller. I wonder what the markings say. Sartak examined another blade, shards of light bouncing over the planes of his handsome face.
Likely spells against enemies. Perhaps even against the...
He halted at the word. Nezrin nodded all the same. The Volg. Half of me hopes we never have to find out. Leaving Sartak to pick one for himself, she fastened the short sword to her belt. As she approached the far wall and the scribbled dark writing along the bottom, she tested each block of stone on the floor, but found nothing. At last, she peered at the script in flaking black letters. Not black, but...
Blood,
Sartak said, coming up beside her, an Asterion knife now at his side. No sign of a body, or any lingering effects of whoever had written it. Perhaps while they lay dying. It's in the Fey tongue, Nezrin said. I don't suppose your fancy tutors taught you the old language during your history lessons?
A shake of the head. She sighed.
We should find a way to write it down. Unless your memory is the sort that...
It's not.
He swore, turning toward the stairs.
I have some paper and ink in Kadara's saddlebags. I could...
It wasn't his cut-off words that made her whirl, but the way he went utterly still. Nezrin slid that fey blade free from where she'd tied it.
There is no need to translate it,
said a light female voice in Halha.
It says, look up. Pity you didn't heed it.
Nezrin indeed looked up at what emerged from the stairwell, crawling along the ceiling toward them. And swallowed her scream. Chapter 34. It was worse than Nezrin had ever dreamed. The Karankui that slid from the ceiling and onto the floor was so much worse. Bigger than a horse. Her skin was black and gray, mottled with splotches of white, her multiple eyes depthless pools of obsidian. And despite her bulk, she was slender and sleek, more black widow than wolf spider.
Those fey morsels forgot to look up when they built this place,
the spider said, her voice so lovely despite her utter monstrosity. Her long front legs clicked against the ancient stone.
To remember who they laid these traps for.
Nezrin sized up the stairwell behind the spider. The light shafts for any exits. Found none. And this watchtower had now become a veritable web. Fool. Utter fool for lingering. The claws at the tops of the spider's legs scraped over the rock. Nezrin sheathed her sword again.
Good,
the spider purred.
Good that you know how useless that fey rubbish will be.
Nezrin drew her bow, knocking an arrow. The spider laughed.
If Fey archers did not halt me long ago, human, you will not now.
Beside her, Sartak's sword lifted a fraction. Dying here, now, had not occurred to her at breakfast while Borte braided her hair. But there was nothing to do as the spider advanced, fangs slipping from her jaws.
When I am done with you, rider, I shall make your birds scream.
Drops of liquid plopped from those fangs. Venom. Then the spider lunged. Nezrin fired an arrow, another aimed before her first found its mark. But the spider moved so swiftly that the blow intended for an eye hit the hard shell of her abdomen, barely embedding. The spider slammed into the stone torture table, as if she'd leap off to pounce on them. Sartak struck, a brutal slash toward the nearest clawed leg. The spider shrieked, black blood spurting, and they hurtled for that distant doorway. The Karen Kui intercepted them first, slammed her legs between the wall and the stone table, blocking their path. So close, the reek of death leaking from those fangs. Human filth, the spider spat, venom spraying onto the stones at their feet. From the corner of her eye, Nezrin saw Sartak fling an arm in her path, to shove her away, to leap in front of those deadly jaws. She didn't know what happened at first, what the blur of motion was, what made the Karen Kui scream. One heartbeat, she'd been ready to fight past Sartak's self-sacrificing idiocy. The next, the spider was crashing through the room, tumbling over and over. Not Kidara, but something large, armed with claws and fangs. A gray wolf, as large as a pony and utterly ferocious. Sartak wasted no time, and neither did Nezrin. They sprinted for the archway and stairs beyond, not caring how many bolts or arrows shot from the walls, as they outraced even the traps. Tearing up the stairs, leaping the gaps between them, they did not stop at the crashing and screeching below. A canine yelp sounded, then silence. Nezrin and Sartak hit the top of the stairs, running for the trees beyond the open doorway. The prince had a hand on her back, shoving her along, both of them half-turned toward the tower. The spider exploded from the gloom, aiming not for the trees, but the upper stairs of the watchtower, as if she'd climb up to ambush the wolf when it chased after her. And exactly as she'd planned, the wolf flew from the stairwell, heading for the open archway to the woods, not even looking behind. The spider leaped. Gold flashed from the skies. Kadara's war cry sent the pines trembling, her claws ripping right into the abdomen of the Karen Kui, and sending her toppling off the stairs. The wolf darted away, as Sartak's roar of warning to his rook was swallowed by the screaming of bird and spider. The Karen Kui landed on her back, precisely where Kidara wanted her, leaving her underbelly exposed to the rook's talons and her blade-sharp beak. A few vicious slashes, black blood spraying and sleek limbs flailing, and silence. Nezrin's bow dangled from her shaking hands as Kidara dismembered the twitching spider. She whirled to Sartak, but his eyes were turned away, to the wolf. She knew, right as the wolf limped toward them, a deep gash in its side, and she beheld its dark sapphire eyes. Knew what it was, who it was, as the edges of his gray coat shimmered, his entire body filling with light that shrank and flowed. And when Falcon waved on his feet before them, a hand pressed to the bloody wound in his ribs, Nezrin breathed, "You're a shapeshifter." Chapter 35. Falcon dropped to his knees, pine needles scattering, blood dribbling between his tan fingers. Nezrin made to rush to him, but Sartak blocked her with an arm. "Don't," he warned. Nezrin shoved his arm out of her way and ran to the injured man, kneeling before him.
"You followed us here."
Falcon lifted his head, pain lining his eyes.
"I listened last night. At your fire."
Sartak snarled, no doubt as some rat or insect. Something like shame indeed filled Falcon's face.
I flew here as a falcon. Saw you go in. Then saw her creep up the hill after you.
He shuddered as he glanced to where Kadara had finished ripping apart the spider and now sat atop the tower, studying him as if he were her next meal. Nezrin waved toward the bird to hop down with their saddlebags. Kadara pointedly ignored her.
He needs help, she hissed to Sartak. Bandages.
Does my edge know? Was all the prince demanded. Falcon tried and failed to remove his blood-soaked hand from his side, panting through his teeth.
Yes, he managed to say. I told her everything.
And what court paid you to come here?
Sartak.
She'd never heard him speak that way, never seen him so furious. She grabbed the prince's arm.
He saved our lives. Now we return the favor.
She pointed to the Rook.
Bandages.
Sartak turned those livid eyes on her.
His kind are assassins and spies,
he snarled.
Better to let him die.
I am neither,
Falcon panted.
I am what I said. A merchant. In Otterland growing up, I didn't even know I had the gift. It ran in my family, but by the time magic vanished, I'd assumed I hadn't gotten it. Was glad for it, but I must not have matured enough, because when I set foot in these lands as a man, as this,
a gesture to his body, to the 20 years he'd given up, he winced against what the movement did to his wound.
I could use it. I could change. Badly and not often. But I can manage it if I concentrate,
he said to the prince.
It is nothing to me, this heritage. It was my brother's gift, my father's. I never wanted it. I still don't.
Yet you can change from bird to wolf to man as easily as if you trained.
Trust me, it's more than I've done in my...
Falcon groaned, swaying. Nezrin caught him before he could eat dirt and snapped at Sartak.
If you don't get him bandages and supplies right now, I'll give you a wound to match.
The prince blinked at her, mouth falling open. Then he whistled through his teeth, sharp and swift, while he strode for Kadara, his steps clipped. The Rook hopped from the tower to land upon one of the owl statues anchored into the archway walls, stone cracking beneath her.
I'm no assassin, Falcon insisted,
still shaking.
I've met a few, but I'm not one.
I believe you, Nezrin said,
and meant it. Sartak hauled the packs off Kadara, searching through them.
The left one, she barked.
The prince threw her another look over his shoulder, but obeyed.
I wanted to kill her myself,
Falcon panted. His eyes glazing, no doubt from blood loss.
To see if that might return the years. Even if she is not the one who took my youth. I thought maybe there was some joint system between them, even across oceans. A web, as it were, of all that their kind has taken.
A bitter, strained laugh.
But it seems my death blow was taken, too.
I think we can all forgive Kadara for doing it instead,
Nezrin said, noting the black blood splattered over the Rook's beak and feathers. Another pained laugh.
You are not scared of what I am.
Sartak strode over with the bandages and salve, and what seemed to be a jar of a honey-like substance, to likely seal the wound until they could reach a healer.
Good. One of my friends is a shifter,
Nezrin admitted, just as Falcon fainted in her arms. They were airborne within minutes of Nezrin cleaning out the gash down Falcon's ribs, and Sartak indeed packing the wound with what seemed to be some sort of leaves and a coating of honey, to keep infection away, and stave the blood loss as they swiftly soared back to the Eyrie. She and the prince barely spoke. Though with Falcon propped behind them, the ride didn't afford much opportunity. It was a tight, perilous flight. Falcon's dead weight occasionally listing far enough to the side that Sartak had to grunt at holding them in the saddle. There were only two sets of buckles, he'd told Nezrin when they climbed onto the saddle. He wasn't wasting either of their lives on a shifter, life debt or no. But they made it. Just as the sun was setting, and the three peaks of the Dorgos were aglow with countless fires, like the mountains were crusted in fireflies. Kadara loosed a shrill scream as they neared the mountain hall of Altoon. Some sort of signal, apparently. Because by the time they landed, Borte, Hulun, and countless others were gathered, armed with supplies. No one asked what happened to Falcon. No one wondered how he'd gotten out there. Either under order from Hulun not to pester them, or simply from the chaos of getting him off the Rook and into a healer's care. No one, except Borte. Sartak was still fuming enough that he led his edge to a corner of the hall to begin demanding answers about the shifter. Or that's what it seemed like, with his set jaw and crossed arms. Hulun only squared off against him, feet braced on the floor, her jaw as tight as his. Alone with Kadara, Nezrin set to unbuckling the packs while Borte observed from a few feet away. That he has the balls to lecture her tells me something went very wrong. And that she is allowing him to do so tells me she feels just a smidge guilty. Nezrin didn't answer, grunting as she hauled down a particularly heavy pack. Borte strode around Kadara, looking the bird over. Carefully. Black blood on her talons, her beak, and chest. Lots of black blood. Nezrin dumped the pack against the wall. And your back is crusted in red blood. From where Falcon had leaned against her during the ride. And that is a new blade. A fey blade. Borte breathed, stepping up to examine the naked blade dangling from her sword belt. Nezrin backed up a step. Borte's mouth tightened. Whatever you know, I want to know it. It's not my call. They glanced toward Sartak, who was still seething, Hulun simply letting him vent. Borte began rattling off items on her fingers. Edge sails off on her own for days. Then you go, returning with a man who did not leave with you and who took no Rook. And poor Kadara returns covered in this foulness. A sniff toward the black blood. The Rook clicked her beak in answer. It's mud, Nezrin lied. Borte laughed. And I'm a fey princess. Either I can start asking around, or... Nezrin dragged her to the wall with the packs. Even if I tell you, you are not to breathe a word of it to anyone or be involved in any way. Borte put a hand on her heart. I swear it. Nezrin sighed toward the distant, rocky ceiling, Kadara giving her a warning look, as if to ask her to reconsider her judgment. But Nezrin told Borte everything. She should have listened to Kadara. Borte, to her credit, did not tell anyone else, other than Sartak, who at last stalked over from Hulun, only to receive an earful and a smack on the shoulder for not informing his hearth sister where he was going. And worse, for not inviting her along. Sartak had glared at Nezrin when he realized who'd told Borte. But she was too tired to care. Instead, she only strode for her room, weaving between the pillars. She knew Sartak was on her heels, thanks to Borte's shouted, "You will bring me next time, you stubborn ass!" And just before Nezrin reached the door to her room, to the sanctuary of a soft bed, the prince gripped her elbow. I would have words with you. Nezrin just shoved into the room, Sartak stalking in behind her, shutting the door and leaning against it. He crossed his arms at the same moment she did. Borte threatened to ask pointed questions around the Eyrie if I didn't tell her.
I don't care.
Nezrin blinked. Then what?
Who has the word keys?
The question echoed between them. Nezrin swallowed.
What's a word key?
Sartak pushed off the door.
Liar,
he breathed. While we were gone, my edge recalled some of the other stories, dragged them up from whatever collective memory she possesses as story keeper. Tales of a word gate that the Volg and their kings passed through. Could open at will with three keys when wielded together. Remembered that those keys went missing after Maeve herself stole them and used them to send the Volg back. Hidden, she says, throughout the world.
Nezrin only lifted a brow. And what of it?
A cold snort. It is how Erewhon has raised an army so quickly. Why, even Aelin of the Wildfire cannot take him on without assistance. He must have at least one. Not all, or we'd be calling Erewhon our master already, but at least one, maybe two. So where is the third?
She honestly had not a clue.
Whether Aelin and the others possessed an inkling, they'd never told her. Only that their ultimate path, beyond war and death, was to retrieve the ones Erewhon held.
But even telling him that... Perhaps now you understand,
Nezrin said with equal cold.
Why we are so desperate for your father's armies.
To be slaughtered.
When Erewhon is done slaughtering us, he will come to your doorstep next.
Sartak swore.
What I saw today, that thing...
He scrubbed his face with shaking hands. The Volg once used those spiders as foot soldiers, legions of them.
He lowered his hands.
Hulun has learned of three other watchtowers in ruin to the south. We'll fly to the first as soon as the shifter is healed.
We're taking Falcon?
Sartak yanked open the door, hard enough that she was surprised he didn't rip it clean off its hinges.
As piss-poor of a shifter as he claims to be. A man who can change into a wolf that big is too good a weapon not to bring into danger.
A sharp glare.
He rides with me.
And where will I be?
Sartak gave her a humorless smile before entering the hall.
You'll be flying with Borte.
Chapter 36 The atrophying in his legs. It was reversing. 3 weeks later, Irene marveled at it. They'd regained movement up through his knee, but not higher. Kaol could bend his legs now, but couldn't move his thighs. Couldn't stand on them. But the morning workouts with the guards? The afternoons spent healing, tangled in darkness and memory and pain? That was muscle, packing back onto his legs. Filling out those already broad shoulders and that impressive chest. Thanks to training in the morning sun, his tan had deepened to a rich brown, the color lying well over arms rippling with muscle. They worked every day in easy rhythm, settling into a routine that became as much a part of Irene as washing her face and cleaning her teeth, and craving a cup of kave when she woke. He'd joined her again at the defense lessons, the youngest acolytes still hopelessly giggly around him, but at least they'd never once been late since he'd arrived. He'd even taught Irene herself new maneuvers regarding taking on larger assailants. And while there were often smiles aplenty in the Torre courtyard, he and Irene were grave as he walked her through those methods, as they considered when she might need them. But there had been no whisper of whoever had attacked her, no confirmation that it was indeed one of the Volg. A small mercy, Irene supposed. But still, she paid attention in his lessons. And still, Kaol carefully trained her. The royal siblings had come and gone and come back again, and she had seen nothing of caution beyond the dinner where she'd sought him out to thank him for his help and generosity the night of the attack. He'd said it was unnecessary, but she had touched his shoulder in thanks anyway, before taking her seat at the safety of Kaol's side. Kaol's own separate cause with the Coggin? Kaol and Irene didn't risk talking about the war, the need for armies, and the Oxara oasis and well of knowledge, which might be hidden away beneath the palms, regarding why this place had such information on the Volg. Neither of them had come up with a way to manipulate Hussar into bringing them without raising her suspicions, without risking the princess becoming aware of those scrolls Irene and Kaol still had hidden in his room. But Irene knew time pressed on him, saw how his eyes sometimes turned distant, as if staring toward a far-off land, remembering the friends who fought there, for their people. He'd always push himself harder after that, and each inch of movement gained in his legs was as much due to himself as it was to her own magic. But Irene pushed herself, too, wondered if the battles had begun, wondered if she'd ever make it in time to even help, wondered what might be left for her to return to. The darkness they encountered when she did heal him, from the demon that had dwelled inside the man who had destroyed so much of the world. They worked through that, too. She had not been dragged into his memories as she had before, had not been forced to witness the horrors of Morath, or endure the attentions of the thing that lingered in him. But her magic still shoved against that wound, swarming it like a thousand dots of white light, eating and gobbling and clawing at it. He endured the pain, wading through whatever that darkness showed him, never recoiling from it, day after day, only stopping when her own strength flagged, and he insisted Irene break for food or a nap on the gold couch, or just some conversation over chilled tea. Irene supposed that their steady pace had to end at some point. She thought it'd likely be due to an argument between them, not news from afar. The Coggin returned to the nightly formal dinner after 2 weeks away at a seaside estate to escape the summer heat, ensconced with his still mourning wife. A merry gathering, or so it had seemed from afar. With no further attacks in the palace or torre, the hushed watchfulness had lifted considerably these last few weeks. But as Irene and Kaol entered the great hall, as she read the simmering tension along those seated at the high table, she debated telling him to leave. Viziers shifted in their seats. Argon, who had certainly not been missed while he joined his parents at the seaside, smirked. Hassar smiled broadly at Irene, knowingly, not good. They got perhaps 15 minutes into dinner before the princess pounced. Hassar leaned forward and said to Kaol,
"You must be pleased tonight, Lord Westfall."
Irene kept perfectly straight in her chair, her fork unfaltering as she lifted a bit of lemon-kissed sea bass to her mouth and forced herself to swallow. Kaol countered smoothly, drinking from his goblet of water.
"And why might that be, Your Highness?"
Hassar's smiles could be awful. Deadly. And the one she wore when she spoke next made Irene wonder why she had ever bothered to answer the princess's summons.
"Well, if one does the calculations, Captain Felix should be returning with my brother tomorrow."
Irene's hand tightened around her fork as she tallied the days. 3 weeks. It had been 3 weeks since Nezrin and Sartak had left for the Tavern Mountains. Nezrin would return tomorrow. And though nothing had happened between Irene and Kaol, Irene could not stop the sensation of her chest caving in. Couldn't halt the sense that there was about to be a door very permanently slammed in her face. They hadn't spoken of Nezrin, of whatever was between them. And he'd never touched Irene more than was necessary. Never looked at her as he had that night of the party. Because of course he was waiting for Nezrin. The woman he was loyal to. Irene made herself eat another bite, even as the fish turned sour in her mouth. Fool. She was a fool, and...
"Didn't you hear the news?"
Kaol drawled, just as irreverently as the princess. He set down his goblet, his knuckles brushing Irene's where she'd rested her hand on the table. To any, it might have been an accidental brush. But with Kaol, his every movement was controlled, focused. The brush of his skin against hers, a whisper of reassurance, as if he could sense that the walls were indeed closing in around her. Hassar shot Irene a displeased look.
"Why did you not inform me of this?"
Irene gave her an innocent wince back.
"I did not know."
It was the truth.
"I suppose you shall tell us,"
Hassar replied coolly to the lord. Kaol shrugged.
"I received word today from Captain Felique.
She and your brother have decided to extend their trip by another 3 weeks. It turns out her skill with a bow and arrow is in high demand amongst his Rukin. They have begged to keep her for a while longer. She obliged them.
Irene schooled her face into neutrality, even as relief and shame washed through her. A good woman. A brave woman. That was who she was so relieved to hear was not returning. Not interrupting.
Our brother is wise, Argan said from down the table. To keep such a skilled warrior for as long as possible.
The barb was there, buried deep.
Kaol again shrugged. He is wise indeed, to know how special she is.
The words were spoken with truth, yet she was inventing things, reading into it, assuming his tone had no affection beyond pride. Argan leaned forward to say to Hasar,
Well, then there's the matter of the other news, sister,
which I assume Lord Westfall has also heard. A few places down, the Coggan's conversation with his closest viziers faltered.
Oh, yes, Hasar said,
swirling her wine as she sprawled in her chair.
I'd forgotten.
Irene tried to catch Renya's eye, to get the princess's lover to reveal something about what she now felt building. The wave about to crash. The reason the room was so charged. But Renya only watched Hasar, a hand on her arm as if to say caution. Not for what she was to reveal, but how Hasar was to reveal it. Kaol glanced between Argan and Hasar. From the prince and princess's smirking, it was clear enough they were aware he hadn't heard. But Kaol still seemed to be debating the merits of appearing knowledgeable, or admitting the truth. Irene spared him from the choice.
I have not heard it, she said. What has happened?
Under the table, Kaol's knee brushed hers in thanks. She told herself it was merely pleasure at the fact he could move that knee that coursed through her, even as dread coiled in her gut.
Well, Hasar began,
the opening chords to a dance she and Argan had coordinated before this meal.
There have been some developments on the neighboring continent, it seems.
Irene now pressed her knee into Kaol's, a silent solidarity.
Together,
she tried to say through touch alone.
Argan said to Irene, to Kaol, and then down to his father, So many developments up north. Royals gone missing, now revealing themselves once more. Both Dorian Havilliard and the Terrasen Queen. The latter did it in such dramatic fashion, too.
Where?
Irene whispered. Because Kaol could not. Indeed, the breath had gone out of him at the mention of his own king. Hasar smiled at Irene. That pleased smile she'd given her upon arrival.
Skull's Bay.
The lie. The guess that Kaol had given her to feed to the princess. It had proved true. She felt Kaol tense, though his face revealed nothing but bland interest.
A pirate port in the south, Great Coggan,
Kaol explained to Urus, seated down the table, as if he were indeed aware of this news and a part of this conversation.
In the middle of a large archipelago.
The Coggan glanced to his visibly displeased viziers and frowned with them.
And why would they appear in Skull's Bay?
Kaol had no answer, but Argan was more than happy to supply it.
Because Aelin Galathinius thought to go head-to-head against the army Parrington had camped at the edge of the archipelago.
Irene slid her hand off the table to grip Kaol's knee. Tension radiated through every hard line of his body. Duva asked, a hand on her growing belly,
Was the win in her favor, or Parrington's?
As if it were a sporting match. Her husband was indeed peering down the table to see the heads swivel.
Oh, in hers, Hasar said. We had eyes in the town already, so they were able to dispatch a full report.
That smug, secret smile again in Irene's direction. Spies she had sent using Irene's information.
Her power is considerable, she added to her father. Our sources say it burned the sky itself, and then wiped out most of the fleet assembled against her, in a single blow.
Holy gods.
The viziers shifted, and the Khagan's face hardened.
The rumors of the glass castle's destruction were not exaggerated, then.
No, Argon said mildly. And her powers have grown since then, along with her allies. Dorian Havilliard travels with her court, and Skulls Bay and its pirate lord now kneel before her.
Conqueror.
They fight with her, Kaol cut in, against Parrington's forces.
Do they?
Hassar took up the assault, parrying with ease.
For it is not Parrington who is now sailing down Ilway's coast, burning villages as he pleases.
That is a lie,
Kaol said too softly.
Is it?
Argon shrugged, then faced his father, the portrait of the concerned son.
No one has seen her, of course. But entire villages have been left in ash and ruin.
They say she sails for Bunjali, intent on strong-arming the Yitgar family into mustering an army for her.
That is a lie, Kaol snapped.
His teeth flashed. Viziers tittered and gasped. But he said to the Khagan,
I know Aelin Galathinius, great Khagan. It's not her style. Not in her nature. The Yitgar family,
he stalled,
is important to her.
Irene felt the words on his tongue, as if they were on her own. The princess and Argon leaned forward, waiting for confirmation. Proof of Aelin Galathinius's potential weakness. Not in magic, but in who was vital to her. And Ilway, lying between Parrington's forces and the Khaganate, she could see the wheels turning in their heads.
The Yitgar family would be better used as an ally from the south,
Kaol corrected, shoulders stiff.
Aelin is clever enough to know this.
And I'd suppose you know, Hassar said, since you were her lover at some point. Or was that King Dorian? Or both? The spies were never accurate on who was in her bed and when.
Irene swallowed her surprise.
Kaol? And Aelin Galathinius?
I know her well, yes,
Kaol said tightly. His knee pressed into her own as if to say,
Later. I will explain later.
But this is war, Argon countered. War makes people do things they might not ordinarily consider.
The condescension and mockery were enough to make Irene grind her teeth. This was a planned attack, a temporary alliance between two siblings. Caution cut in.
Does she set her sights on these shores?
It was a soldier's question, meant to assess the threat to his land, his king. Hassar picked at her nails.
Who knows? With such power, perhaps we're all hers for the taking.
Aelin has one war to fight already, Kaol ground out, and she is no conqueror.
Skulls Bay and Ilway would suggest otherwise.
A vizier whispered in the Khagan's ear. Another leaned in to listen, already calculating. Kaol said to Urus,
Great Khagan, I know some might spin these tidings to appear to Aelin's disadvantage, but I swear to you, the Queen of Terrasen means only to liberate our land. My king would not ally with her if it were otherwise.
Would you swear it, though?
Hassar mused.
Swear on Irene's life?
Kaol blinked at the princess. From all you have seen, Hassar went on,
all you've witnessed of her character, would you swear it upon Irene Towers's life? That Aelin Galathinius might not use such tactics? Might not try to take armies rather than raise them? Including our own?
Say yes. Say yes. Kaol didn't so much as look at Irene as he stared down Hassar. Then Argon. The Khagan and his viziers pulled apart. Kaol said nothing. Swore nothing.
Hassar's small smile was nothing short of triumphant.
I thought so.
Irene's stomach turned. The Khagan took Kaol's measure.
If Parrington and Aelin Galathinius are rallying armies, perhaps they'll destroy each other and spare me the trouble.
A muscle flickered in Kaol's jaw.
Perhaps if she's so powerful, Argan mused, she can take on Parrington by herself.
Don't forget King Dorian,
Hassar chimed in.
Why, I'd bet the two of them could handle Parrington and whatever army he's built without much assistance. Better to let them deal with it than waste our blood on foreign soil.
Irene was shaking, trembling with rage at the careful play of words. The game Hassar and her brother had constructed to keep from sailing to war.
But,
caution countered, seeming to note Irene's expression.
It might also be said that if we do assist such powerful royals, the benefits in years of peace might be far worth the risks now.
He twisted to the Khagan.
If we go to their aid, father, should we ever face such a threat? Imagine that power turned against our enemies.
Or turned against us if she finds it easier to break her oaths,
Argan cut in. The Khagan studied Argan, his eldest son now frowning with distaste at caution. Duva, a hand still on her pregnant belly, only watched, unnoted and unasked for, even by her husband. Argan turned back to his father.
Our people's magic is minimal. The eternal sky and the 36 gods blessed our healers mostly,
a frown at Irene.
Against such power, what is steel and wood?
Aelin Galathinius took Rifthold, then took Skull's Bay, and now seems poised to take Eelway. A wise ruler would have gone north, fortified her kingdom, then pushed south from the borders.
Yet she stretches her forces thin, dividing them between north and south. If she is not a fool, then her advisors are. They are well-trained warriors who have seen more war and battle than you ever will,
Kaol said coldly. The eldest prince stiffened. Hassar laughed quietly. The Khagan again weighed the words around him.
This remains a matter to discuss in council rooms, not dinner tables,
he said, though there was no reassurance in it. Not for Kaol, not for Irene.
Though I am inclined to agree with what the bare facts offer.
To his credit, Kaol did not argue further. Did not flinch or scowl. He only nodded once.
I thank you for the honor of your continued consideration, Great Khagan.
Argan and Hassar swapped sneering looks, but the Khagan just returned to his meal. Neither Irene nor Kaol touched the rest of their food.
Bitch. The princess was a bitch, and Argan was as fine a bastard as any Kaol had ever encountered.
There was some truth to their reluctance, their fear of Aelin's powers and the threat she might pose. But he read them, knew Hassar simply did not want to leave the comforts of her home, her lover's arms, to sail to war, did not want the messiness of it. And Argan, the man dealt in power, in knowledge. Kaol had no doubt Argan's arguing against him was more to force Kaol into a spot where he'd be desperate, even more than he was. Willing to offer anything up for their aid. Caution would do whatever his father told him. And as for the Khagan. Hours later, Kaol was still grinding his teeth, as he lay in bed and stared at the ceiling. Irene had left him with a squeeze to his shoulder, promising to see him the next day. Kaol had barely been able to reply. He should have lied, should have sworn he trusted Aelin with his life. Because Hassar had known that if she asked him to swear upon Irene's life. Even if their 36 gods did not care about him, he couldn't risk it. He had seen Aelin do terrible things. He still dreamed of her gutting Archer Finn in cold blood. Still dreamed of what she'd left of Graves' body in that alley. Still dreamed of her butchering men like cattle, in Rifthold and in Endovir.
and knew just how unfeeling and brutal she could turn. He had quarreled with her earlier this summer about it. The checks on her power. The lack of them. Rowan was a good male, utterly unafraid of Aelin, her magic. But would she listen to his counsel? Adian and Aelin were as likely to come to blows as they were to agree, and Lysandra. Kaol didn't know the shifter well enough to judge whether she'd keep Aelin in line. Aelin had indeed changed. Grown into a queen. Was still growing into one. But he knew that there were no restraints, no inner ones, on how far Aelin would go to protect those she loved. Protect her kingdom. And if someone stood in her way, barred her from protecting them? No lines existed to cross within Aelin in regard to that. No lines at all. So he had not been able to swear it, on Irene's life, that he believed Aelin might be above those sorts of methods. With her fraught history with Rolf, she likely had used the might of her magic to intimidate him into joining their cause. But with Eowyn, had they given some sign of resistance to prompt her to terrorize them? He couldn't imagine it, that Aelin would consider hurting innocent people, let alone the people of her beloved friend. And yet she knew the risks that Parrington, Erewhon, posed. What he'd do to them all if she did not band them together, by whatever means necessary. Kaol rubbed his face. If Aelin had kept herself in check, if she'd played the part of distressed queen, it would have made his task far easier. Perhaps Aelin had cost them this war, this one shot at a future. At least Dorian was accounted for. Undoubtedly as safe as could be expected with Aelin's court for companions. Kaol sent a silent prayer of thanks into the night for that small mercy. A soft knock had him shooting up, not from the foyer, but the glass doors to the garden. His legs twitched, bending slightly at the knee, more reaction than controlled movement. He and Irene had been going through the grueling leg routines twice a day. The various therapies buying him movement inch by inch, along with the magic she poured into his body while he endured the darkness's horde of memories. He never told her what he saw, what left him screaming. There was no point. And telling Irene how badly he'd failed, how wrongly he'd judged, it made him just as nauseated. But what stood in the night-veiled garden? Not a memory. Kaol squinted into the dark at the tall male figure standing there, a hand raised in quiet greeting, Kaol's own hand drifting to the knife beneath his pillow. But the figure stepped closer to the lantern light, and Kaol blew out a breath and waved the prince in. With a flick of a small knife, Kashan unlocked the garden door and slipped in.
Lock-picking isn't a skill I'd expect a prince to possess, Kaol said by way of greeting.
Kashan lingered just inside the doorway, the lantern from outside illuminating enough of his face for Kaol to make out a half-smile.
Learned more for sneaking in and out of ladies' bedrooms than stealing, I'm afraid. I thought your court was a bit more open in regard to that sort of thing than my own.
That smile grew.
Perhaps, but cranky old husbands remain the same on either continent.
Kaol chuckled, shaking his head.
What can I do for you, prince?
Kashan studied the door to the suite, Kaol doing the same, searching for any flickering shadows on the other side. When they both found none, Kashan said,
I assume you have discovered nothing within my court about who might be tormenting Irene. I wish I could say otherwise.
But with Nezrin gone, he'd had little chance to hunt through Antica for any signs of a would-be Volg agent. And things had indeed been quiet enough these 3 weeks, that part of him had hoped they'd just left. A considerably calmer atmosphere had settled over the palace and Torre since then, as if the shadows were indeed behind them all. Kashan nodded.
I know Sartak departed with your captain to seek answers regarding this threat.
Kaol didn't dare confirm or deny. He wasn't entirely certain where Sartak had left things with his family, if he'd received his father's blessing to go. Kashan went on,
That might just be why my siblings mounted such a unified front against you tonight. If Sartak himself takes this threat seriously, they know they might have a limited window to convince our father not to join this cause.
But if the threat is real,
Kaol said,
if it might spill into these lands, why not fight? Why not stop it before it can reach these shores?
Because it is war, Kashin said. And the way he spoke, the way he stood, it somehow made Kaol feel young indeed. And though the manner in which my siblings presented their argument was unpleasant, I suspect Argon and Hasar are aware of the costs that joining your cause requires. Never before has the entire might of the Khaganate's armies been sent to a foreign land. Oh, some legions, whether it be the Rukin or the Armada or my own horse lords, sometimes united, but never all. Never what you require. The cost of life, the sheer drain on our coffers, it will be great. Don't make the mistake of believing my siblings don't understand that very, very well.
And their fear of Aelin?
Kashin snorted. I cannot speak to that. Perhaps it is well-founded. Perhaps it is not.
So you snuck into my room to tell me?
He should speak with more respect, but
I came to tell you one more piece of information, which Argon chose not to mention.
Kaol waited, wishing he weren't sitting in bed, bare from the waist up. Kashin said,
we received a report from our vizier of foreign trade that a large, lucrative order had been placed for a relatively new weapon.
Kaol's breathing snagged. If Morath had found some way...
It is called a fire lance, Kashin said.
Our finest engineers made it by combining various weapons from across our continent.
Oh, gods. If Morath had it in its arsenal.
Captain Rolf ordered them for his fleet.
Months ago.
Rolf. And when news arrived of Skull's Bay falling to Aelin Galathinius, it also came with an order for even more fire lances to be shipped northward.
Kaol sorted through the information. Why wouldn't Argon say this at dinner?
Because the fire lances are very, very expensive.
Surely that's good for your economy.
It is. And not good for Argon's attempt to avoid this war.
Kaol fell silent for a heartbeat. And you, Prince? Do you wish to join this war?
Kashin didn't answer immediately. He scanned the room, the ceiling, the bed, and finally Kaol himself.
This will be the great war of our time,
Kashin said quietly.
When we are dead, when even our grandchildren's grandchildren are dead, they will still be talking about this war. They will whisper of it around fires, sing of it in the great halls. Who lived and died, who fought and who cowered. His throat bobbed. My Sulde blows northward, day and night. The horsehairs blow north. So perhaps I will find my destiny on the plains of Fenharrow, or before the white walls of Orinth. But it is northward that I shall go, if my father will order me.
Kaol mulled it over, looked to the trunks against the wall near the bathing chamber. Kashin had turned to leave when Kaol asked,
when does your father next meet with his foreign trade vizier?
Chapter 37 Nezrin had run out of time. Falcon required 10 days to recover, which had left her and Sartak with too little time to visit the other watchtower ruins to the south. She'd tried to convince the prince to go without the shapeshifter, but he'd refused. Even with Borte now intent on joining them, he was taking no risks. But Sartak found other ways to fill their time. He'd taken Nezrin to other areas to the north and west, where he met with the reigning hearth mothers and the captains, both male and female, who led their forces. Some were welcoming, greeting Sartak with feasts and revels that lasted long into the night. Some, like the Burlad, were aloof, their hearth mothers and other various leaders not inviting them to stay for longer than necessary,
certainly not bringing out jugs of the fermented goat's milk that they drank. And that was strong enough to put hair on Nezrin's chest, face, and teeth.